than 100,000 million kalpas. Now I can see and hear it, accept and maintain it. May we unfold the meaning of the Tathagata's truth.
Present my friend and colleague, Shoryu Bradley, from Gyobutsuji near Fayetteville in Arkansas in the Ozark Mountains. Shoryu began sitting at Austin Zen Center some years ago, and then practiced with Shohaku Okumura, and his certification to teach, his Dharma transmission, is from Shohaku-san. He has practiced both at Tassajara in California and at Shoboji, where I practiced. We were not there. I think we were separated by about 20 years.
Right. You were there a lot longer than I was, too.
And he has, as I mentioned, a little rural monastery temple in the wilds of Arkansas. And so I present Shoryu.
Thank you very much. And good morning to everyone. On this beautiful fall morning. It's great to be here, and I really appreciate being invited to come and talk to you. We've been sitting for the last day, yesterday, and then this morning, of course, too. So we've had our little intimate sitting, and now a lot of people come in, and it's a little bit different, but it's nice to have, you know, the extra people here and to have the energy change, so to speak, a little bit. But I did talk yesterday. This talk that I'm going to give you is designed to be sort of the second half of that one. So hopefully I can kind of tell you a little bit about what I said yesterday. It'll make sense to you. Basically, the talk is about fire. I started out talking about the Buddha's early teaching of the fire sermon, and he basically said that all of our experience was a problem. Everything that we can experience is suffused with this greed, hate, and delusion. And that's because there's an object out there, and then we have a sense organ, including the mind is one of those sense organs. And when those two things meet, some kind of reaction happens, some kind of consciousness comes up. And we think that we're experiencing the thing in itself, but we're actually experiencing this reaction. So the delusion part really comes in strong there, because all of our past activities, everything that's gone into producing who we are in this moment, is affecting the way that you perceive that thing. The way that that object, you know, is conditioned. But that we usually just think we're seeing things as they are, and that we believe in our preferences. That was another thing that he pointed out. We believe in the greed when it comes up, or the hatred, or the delusion. And we think that that's the way we need to interact with those objects. And that's the strategy for our life, basically, usually. For most human beings. But this is all a description of the self, of how we experience our life. And it's been described in many different ways throughout the history of Buddhism. In another sutra called the Lotus Sutra, you may be familiar with, this fire imagery was also taken up in one of the parables presented there. And I think you guys, you said you studied this, so you probably could be familiar with this already. This is the parable of the burning house, and basically the Buddha is teaching about how, well, this story is designed to talk about how all many different traditions are actually part of one intent for us to awaken. And different people in different cultures, different societies are given different teachings according to what they need. And but they're all part of this great teaching, this great Mahayana. But in explaining the parable or the predicament that we're in this particular instance, the Buddha talks about the burning house, that there's a man who has who's very wealthy. He has a house, and his children are staying in the house, and many other people too. He has many children and many servants, so forth, and this fire breaks out, and everybody's in danger, but nobody's coming out. There's a small entranceway, and he warns his children. He says, come on out. You need to get out of here. You're going to burn up. We're all going to burn up. We need to get out. And but nobody comes out because they're too busy playing with their toys. They're playing with their games, and they're distracted. They don't pay any attention to him. So the Buddha, or the elder, to get the people out, to get his children out, he offers them toys that are better than those that are they're playing with. And he offers them a toy that's commensurate with their preferences. So it's kind of part of the point is, you know, we come to practice and we're offered something that we think is going to make us better, or we're going to get enlightened, or something's going to happen that we think is really good. But what actually happens in practice is way beyond our comprehension, and we get something much better than our tiny little desires can grasp, you know. But I was interested the last time I read this, especially in the fact that everyone's playing with toys. And so we talked about it yesterday a bit, how this is really a toy type of culture, and toys are presented to us, and we have the opportunity to play with toys on many different levels. And so we talked about some yesterday. We talked about technology, cell phones, cars. There, it's endless. Movies, TV, romance, all of these things can be toys, just that distract us from our own condition, from our experience, from the burning house, from the condition that we need to really do something here. But part of the problem is the toys keep us from seeing our predicament. We don't even feel the suffering that we're feeling, really. And that's a problem, because then there's no way to address it. I was saying yesterday, sometimes it reminds me of like Christmas time in a big family, if the kids get a lot of gifts and they're all piled up. And I've seen it happen before, maybe you guys have too, but there's kind of a present opening frenzy. And you know, everybody just opens a present, goes on to the next one, kind of just throws one over the shoulder and goes on to the next one. And, you know, the lure of the new toy is really what's going on, rather than meeting the toy itself. And so I think this happens with us too. In fact, we talked about how cell phones, you know, fill up landfills, all these cell phones being produced, but all of the technology is such a great tool in a way, but there's always a shadow, of course. In fact, we can use the earth itself as a toy. You know, that's actually what we have done at this point. We're waking up from that. and trying to remedy that, of course, but it's very seductive, the toys that we're offered to play with. And unfortunately, the attitude can extend even to, of course, people in our lives. Have you ever been in a relationship or been, you know, just interacting with someone in which you felt that something changed suddenly and somebody was just discarded? It might have been you or it might have been the other person, but, you know, somebody was just discarded and there's a feeling of being used, maybe. This happens a lot on a lot of different levels. And that happens when we use just solely our own desires as the measure of something's worth. You know, romance is used a lot, I think, in our culture. It's pervasive, very pervasive in movies, songs. And we get this idea that we're supposed to meet somebody and they're just going to fulfill all our dreams. We're more sophisticated than this now, of course. I think earlier in this, the last century, was the story was really less sophisticated, and so the Prince Charming kind of story isn't swallowed so well anymore, but it's still there very subtly, and it's very pervasive that we think that someone else is going to do the work for us, you know, that when we meet them, basically. That someone else is going to make us feel good, someone else is going to make life okay, because we're going to be happy when we meet them. I read somewhere once that actually, and the problem is, I think, is that we get addicted to the feeling of being in love or being attracted, rather than settling down into the work of having a relationship. And I read somewhere that the feeling of being in love can only last like 6 months or 2 years. It's really mostly chemically based. And, you know, whatever theory you want to take, evolutionary or whatever, it's something that has its use. And then, it, like everything else, it changes. So you see that happen. Sometimes people going from one relationship to the other, trying to get the feeling. Some of us get addicted to the feeling of being dumped, actually, to tell you the truth, and we don't even know it. But the feeling of sorrow, the feeling of tragedy, of you know, our life falling apart, we get, that's another toy, and we get addicted to that. the sorrow and the grief, they're all toys, actually, if we don't address them for what they are, the source of what's happening, rather than just going on and finding another situation in which it's actually going to be reproduced again, the same feeling, whether we consciously do that or not. We get addicted to a feeling of being right, I think, is another very seductive feeling. I was at my folks' house a few months ago down in Texas, and I usually watch the TV a bit and listen to radio a little bit just to see what's going on. And the political talk shows that are on TV, the intensity that can be presented in these things, and the radio shows, and it's so much fun, you know, to be pissed off at somebody else. Oh, sorry, I said a bad word. Probably heard it before. I did. I forgot. I lost control on it. So that's another one. And this can happen anywhere in any time. It can happen on a more subtle basis. It can happen in our practice, for example. We like to feel like we're doing things right. We've got the right way. And any other way is wrong. And you better, you know, tell somebody about it if it's wrong. Or you can get addicted to the feeling of being wrong, of doing it wrong, and feeling you're persecuted. There's a bully over there, you know, the Zen Nazi or whatever, you know, trying to tell you what to do. All of these are opportunities for practice, and the forms are very important in our tradition, but they're all made up. You know, somebody made them up. Somebody made them up somewhere down the line, but so we can't take them as some kind of ultimate truth. They're definitely not, but they're very important because they give us a way to practice. If we don't have a form, we can't practice. The Zazen posture itself is a form, and so we have to have a form to express this thing, this life, our practice. So that's why when we have the form, we try to do it the best we can. But if somehow we don't, it's okay. You go on and try to do it better next time. But even more subtle than that, sometimes we're... You know, another thing we do with toys is we like to compare the toys with each other's toys. We like to, we like to have a better car. We like to have a more beautiful boyfriend or girlfriend, or a better job, or you know, the latest computer, whatever it might be. Or we might feel good if we've done more sesshins than the other person, or we come here more often, or whatever it might be, you know. Or you know, we're doing this all the time. So something else to practice with, feeling right, feeling better, and comparing. The Buddha Dharma is not a competitive sport. It's just what you're doing here now. Do it fully, but it's not about comparison. Of course, the list could go on with the toys, but something a little bit harder to practice with, or harder to deal with even than all of these toys that are in our culture, is the toys that are so subtle. Actually, Dogen Zenji taught this, the Buddha taught this, that all of our thoughts and emotions and feelings are actually part of this burning house, part of the toy problem, everything. It's in the nature of whatever it is this is. It's just in the nature of things to arise with this desire or aversion. That's what... So we spend a lot of our time, as I say, distracting ourselves from the feeling of anger or greed, rather than facing them. So that's why sometimes when we come to practice itself, and we settle down a little bit, we start sitting Zazen, we're kind of almost freaked out by what we're feeling. Mm-hmm. And it seems really intense, and like somehow this practice is messing me up. You know, I'm getting more angry by practicing. But that's the subtlety there, though, that we're starting to meet, you know, in practice. Mm. But it can make us feel more and more like we're really, you know, in a fix. How do we get out of this? This is just everywhere you turn, there's this greed, hate, and delusion. And there's really, what can you do about it? So here's a clue. I think we all know the answer, but Dogen Zenji said, you know, as long as we think about the Buddha Dharma with our minds, we will never grasp the way, even in 1,000 lifetimes or a myriad of eons. When we let go of our minds and cast aside our views and understandings of the way, the way will be actualized. When we completely cast aside our thoughts and views and practice Shikan Taza, we become intimate with the way. So traditionally in the burning house, the different vehicles represent different sort of traditions, with the first cart. They're offered vehicles, carts, a goat cart and a deer cart and a bull cart. And maybe we could update it and say a bicycle, motorcycle, Mercedes, something like that. I don't know. But that's, you know, some people like bicycles more than the Mercedes, actually. I used to be one of those. So you give the person what, you know, what they like. And but the interesting thing to me is that the Bodhisattva way, well, let me say this, of course, the first two vehicles are considered sort of lesser because you're practicing just for yourself. You know, this is the theory. Or it's more of an attitude rather than a criticism, I think, you know, the way we can interpret this. This is an attitude towards practice rather than a criticism of any other tradition. So when we do this, though, all the time, we're actually going through these different carts all the time, whether we realize it or not. You come to practice because you want to get better, you want to get more relaxed, you want to come out of the house, or you want to do something different than what you're doing. But then we realize that we're in this all together, and we get presented the Bodhisattva teaching, and so we want to practice and with others and help others as well, too. But it's very interesting to me that the parable actually says that they come out and they get something better than even that. That even the Bodhisattva vehicle, if I'm reading this right, we don't understand. We come out and get something even greater than that, the Mahayana itself, our idea of what the Mahayana is. And to me that says, well... even when we say we're practicing for others, we're still practicing in the realm of self and other. You know, the duality of the burning house or the fire sermon is still there. Even if we say we're doing it for me, we're doing it for them, or we're doing it for all of us together. And it was one of the points the Buddha had in that fire sermon, that even the teaching he was giving was on fire. You know, anything you say, because of the nature of our language and the way things are set up, causes a duality between what's really going on and reality itself. So when they come out and get the great vehicle, the Mahayana vehicle, it's actually more great than anybody can imagine. I know it's a lot of talking here. It's a lot for everybody to sit through. I started thinking about this. Actually, Uchiyama Roshi did a talk about this word maha. I remember reading once from Sanskrit, which means means great, big. It can be an honorific, you know, for people or things. But especially later in Mahayana Buddhism, I think in Asia, it became to mean incomparable, like you can't compare it to anything else. And so to me, that means, you know, you can't compare something to anything else when it includes everything. So that's what's beyond comparison, because everything else we can think of, that you can compare it to something else. But it's incomprehensible because it's all pervading, and it's where our thinking itself is included in it. It can't grasp it because we're a tiny part of it. So this is our Zazen we're talking about here. I think the Mahayana is the Zazen. Because when we sit Zazen, we let go of all of our ideas of this teaching, the burning house, you know, self and other, Bodhisattva, and we just sit in the reality itself, and we let all of those thoughts come up, but we don't grasp onto them the way the Buddha taught, you know, was the problem. We don't grasp onto them, or we don't say, go away. We just let them come up, and then we let them go away on their own. So there's no, you know, grasping or aversion. Or there may be grasping or aversion that comes up, but we let go of that. We just keep letting go. Because, yeah, a lot of anger comes up sometimes. The feelings of feeling good or bad in Zazen, or it's not just thoughts, it's everything that comes up. We let go and just come back to here and now. So I think this is our coming out of the burning house, is our Zazen practice. Dogen Zenji said this. He said, sitting itself is the practice of the Buddha. Sitting itself is non-doing. It is nothing but the true form of the self. Apart from sitting, there is nothing to seek as the Buddha Dharma. So Zazen is the only time we completely let all of our toys go. You just let them all go. You don't play, you know. Well, it's interesting, actually. I was just going to say, actually, we don't play with anything in Zazen, but I'm not really sure if that's true. We don't play with anything. But I always love this when I think of it. Dogen Zenji said that in the beginning of Bendo Wa, he starts describing Zazen. He said, for disporting oneself freely, or for playing freely in samadhi, practicing Zazen in the upright posture is the true gate for opening up enlightenment. Yes. So what kind of play is that? That's a play that's done solely for itself. You know, the way I heard a Zen master, my teacher told me this, a Zen master describes Zazen as the same attitude a kid has in a sandbox of filling up a pail of sand. You ever watch kids play like that? They do it just for itself, you know, just for the play itself. There's no greed, hate, and delusion. There's no object to run after, but it is a play. It's complete freedom, complete relaxation in a certain way. So, but what does this have to do, though, with our everyday life? We can't just sit in Zazen all the time. We can't every time. I mean, although some would say it's been tried. certain traditions, especially, or certain lineages. But we can't remove ourselves, of course, from the subject-object relationship. It's the way that we function. It's the only way we can have a place here for people to sit. It's the only way we can open the doors up and set up an altar, offer incense, put out the cushions. We have to say, this is what I'm going to do, and I'm going to do it. And that all involves, you know, discrimination. A subject and an object, basically. But So this is why it's important for us to understand the meaning of our Zazen, I think. And it's not that our Zazen is the most important thing that we do. You know, it's the center of our life, not because for whatever reason we might think that it's a religious form handed down. But this is where we get the attitude and where we learn how to treat things. And how to face the world is by being informed by, you know, the truth that we're immersed in Zazen. And we, you know, we let this suffuse our life off of the cushion. And you can think about a lot of the ways, we can kind of intellectually think about the ways that it can do that. I mean, for me, one of the things is that, as we were talking about earlier, we become more aware of our suffering, actually, in the way that we treat things badly, or I've done this, and so I begin seeing that can work on it a little bit better when my anger comes up. Maybe I have an extra moment sometimes to say, wait, you know. But I think that's part of the fruit or the merit of Zazen, because until we become intimate with that anger or that greed, we have no tool to deal with it. And and I think it's interesting, you know, in the tradition too, how much fire is used. You know, you think about fire, It's very dangerous, and it can run wild and destroy, you know, mass forests and people's homes and what have you. But a human being can't live without it, basically. We have to have fire. And it's a matter of understanding our relationship with it and treating it and using it, you know, in the way that is wholesome and effective. But, you know, if we didn't have any fire, we'd be out of luck. We need fire. And I think this is illustrated through the teachings, you know, a lot of different places. And in fact, in the Lotus Sutra itself, there's, you know, later, towards the end of the sutra, there's a bodhisattva that sets himself on fire as an offering to the Buddhas. You know, and this is an allegory, a metaphor, of course. It's not something we're being taught to do, literally, I don't think. But this is what, you know, is saying, I think part of what I'm saying here is to putting our total passion into what we're doing now wholeheartedly. And you don't do that by stuffing down your emotions, but it's by coming to understand them, honor them, you know, being able to manage them and put them to work for you. You don't want to become somebody else. You want to become completely 100%, you know, who we are, because we spend a lot of energy trying to be somebody else, trying to think of, you know, who should I be, and who is a good Zen person, who's a good Zen practitioner, who is a good husband, or who's a good wife, or rather than discovering, you know, who we are, and being the best at, you know, bringing out the best things in ourselves, and developing those things, and working on the things that we can see are not so good, our shadow parts too, that we find are not so wholesome. We have to become intimate with those things so that we can manifest things that are more wholesome, I think. And I don't think it necessarily means that everybody has to go to therapy or whatever, and you have to figure out all of your stuff and blame it on your parents or whatever, you know. Although that can be helpful somewhat to know the emptiness of the situation, as far as like you were raised in a certain environment, so this is what happens when a person is raised in this environment, they tend to do this kind of thing. But, you know, if we get into blaming, if you just move, shuffle around the blame, saying, well, that person is the reason I'm so messed up, you know, you're doing the blaming game, and you're saying you're messed up, when both of those things are not good. So it's a matter of maybe these kinds of things can show us that everything is interconnected, and causes and conditions go into producing who we are, and can give us insight into the causes and conditions that will support us to manifest something wholesome that we want to manifest. But as far as, you know, an ultimate way, it's not necessarily everyone's way. Okay, I think that's about all I have to say this morning. And I think we end at 10:30, so it's about time. I did want to say just one or two other things about being here and how much I've enjoyed being in Sesshin and being here and supported. And it's such a nice thing to have someone else cook for you and you know, ring the bells for you and open the doors, and, you know, especially if you're used to doing that a lot yourself. But you have, Zuiko-san is doing a great job here. She's doing a beautiful job. And I think she works really hard. My observations, maybe she could use some more help, I'm thinking. Just a little hint there. If you're ever wanting to, you know, make an offering to the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, and you've got it right here. Yeah, I think there's a lot of work to be done around here. But I want to thank her very much for providing this opportunity. for me.
May this merit extend universally to all, so that we together with all beings realize the good of beings are numberless. I vow to free them. Illusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. The Buddha way is unsurpassable. I vow to realize it.